Rural News Now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Good morning and welcome to the Virtual Faculty Lounge at Stratford University. This is Tech Talk Radio. I'm your host this Saturday morning, Jim Russ. And coming up on today's show, we have two profiles in IT for you. One, at listener's request, somebody from past times, and another about somebody currently involved in the IT scene. We'll also talk about a TV anchor who's gotten himself into some hot water over reading a colleague's email. And, of course, your chance to win free food from us at Stratford University. But first...
And, of course, it was a very huge mailbag.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
See, I never know these days. You have kind of mixed up how you get into it, so I'm never quite sure what my cue is.
Well, we try to always just sort of keep things on the edge here.
Edgy would be one word, yes.
That's right. We got a letter from Yen Hua. Dear Dr. Schertz, while visiting my sister Nan in Georgia... Oh, my goodness, it's another
email. You're kidding
me. It's another email from Georgia. Last weekend, my other sister, Hawk, told us about your show, and we downloaded the MP3 from the website and listened to it. I'm happy to learn that I can listen to your show whenever I want when I return to Maryland. I have a question concerning online shopping. I often surf the web looking for bargains online, but I've wondered how I can make sure that the online shopping site I'm looking at is not a fake.
Mm-hmm.
How can I make sure I'm not giving my credit card number to some scam artist? Your new listener, Yen Hua. Actually, that is a problem when you start just surfing around the web and picking up any websites. One thing you can do, you can see whether there's actually a mailing address, a physical mailing address. A lot of these scam sites have no physical mailing address, so you can't even tell what country they're in.
Right.
Check for a physical mailing address. The other thing I would do when there is a scam site, usually people write about it in the blogs, I would do a Google search and see if there's any negative publicity about the site when you do a Google search with the name of that site, or you could just use some keywords like site XX, unhappy, site XX, a ripoff, or just any kind of words like that to see whether you'd come up with something that would show any kind of negativity about the site. Also, I would beware of sites that are outside the United States. There are certain sites in Asia that you really can't trust, and so you've got to be very careful about those, especially if you give your credit card number with them. And if you finally do select a site, you want to make certain that you secure socket layer so your credit card is safe. Now, I typically use sites that are commonly used, and there's a track record on them. I don't find a site that I don't know anything about and just use it, because that is a problem. The other thing I do is if I use a particular credit card on the web, I make certain to check that credit card to see if there are any bogus charges
right.
that come up after it. You know, so you can, you know, you just want to check your account, make certain there's not some unknown charge, because if one of these sites makes an improper charge to your credit card, you can get it reversed with the credit card company. They'll take care of that. That was a good question.
Yep.
Thank you, Yen. Now we have a new listener.
Exactly.
Very good. We got an email from Leslie. I have an iPhone and frequently get text messages from other iPhone users with special little symbols, like, you know, flags and people. I can't figure out how they embed them into their text message. Can you explain how they do that? Thanks, Leslie. Well, what they've done, Leslie, is that they've installed an international keyboard that has all those symbols. And the name of that keyboard is Emoji, E-M-O-J-I. That's also on, the iPhone 3.
Which is why I've got mine out here, because I'm going to kind of walk through
So what you want to do is you want to install the Emoji international keyboard. And so you simply go to the settings icon and then click General, which are the general settings, and then you scroll down a bit, and you'll see something called keyboard. Click on keyboard, And then once you click on keyboard, click on international keyboards or everything. And then in international keyboards, there's a button that says add new keyboard. Click on that.
Yep.
That gives you a list of all these keyboards. Scroll down till you get to emoji, E-M-O-J-I. Click on that. As soon as you click on it, you're done. And then you can go back to a text message, and you'll notice that when you do the try to start entering your text message and the keyboard comes up, there's going to be a little globe down in the lower left-hand corner that symbolizes international keypads, keyboards, and you click on that globe and all the emojis come up.
Dr. Schertz?
Yes.
I don't have that on mine.
You don't have emoji?
No, it goes from Dutch to Estonian to Finnish, and emoji is not on there.
E-M-O-J-O?
Yeah.
That is just a shame. I don't know. I've never used a 3 before, iPhone 3. But I can't believe it's not on there.
No, it's not. Isn't that crazy?
It is. They are all in alphabetical
order.
You're
in alphabetical order, yeah. I'm going through this like for the third time now.
Well,
I was so excited too.
Well, listen, what I'm going to do, I'm going to send you a text message with a symbol in it just so you can have its symbol and envy.
Okay.
Now, here's the thing. These symbols only work if you send it to another iPhone. So if you send this symbol to a non-iPhone text message, it shows up as some text character that they won't even understand what it is. So it's just really iPhone-to-iPhone communication. We got an email from Dustin. Greetings. I'm a relatively new employee at Stratford University. Last weekend, I listened to the show for the first time. That was a very wise move.
It was an incredibly wise move.
It was a very wise. And I really enjoyed the segment on Alan Turing, since I'm currently working on my master's degree in math. My question for the show is this. Given the recent power outage, are solar chargers these days worth the investment? Thanks, Dustin. Well, Dustin, I think solar chargers for your cell phone probably do make sense. You know, I had to go out and start up the car, crank up the car and charge up my cell phone because we had no power. But if you don't have that option, actually you can get a solar charger for a cell phone, and it will charge your cell phone up in a couple of hours in bright sunlight, maybe 2 or 3 hours. They do have solar chargers for laptops, but you probably have to leave those on all day.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a little bit more expensive because it takes more juice to charge a laptop. I have flashlights that have solar chargers on them. So I've just sit with this one flashlight in the windowsill, and it is always charged up whenever I have an emergency. It's a little LED flashlight. That was probably worth doing it. And the cost of solar charging is coming down because what has happened in the last 3 years, the price of silicon has just gone down. It's about 10% of what it was 3 years ago. So the price of silicon solar cells is just dropping down. And at the same time, because the raw materials are cheaper, and at the same time, China has ramped up production, even driving the prices lower yet. So traditional silicon solar cells coming out of China are hitting a rock bottom.
Huh.
That's why companies like Solyndra went out of business. They couldn't compete.
Right.
Because all of these green solutions were using non-silicon solutions, trying to, you know, get around the high cost of silicon. And all of a sudden, silicon got cheap.
So there you go.
And then production got ramped up in China. And so all these green initiatives were just down the toilet. And that's what happened to Solyndra. They could not sell their devices and compete with China. But you get the advantage, Dustin, of being able to get now chargers at a much lower price. That's the byproduct. That's why I gave that sidebar note. We got an email from LL in Bethesda. Dear Doc, a few months ago I wrote two user's guides in Microsoft PowerPoint 2010 that takes users through a custom-built automation tool. Both of my user's guides have a whole lot of screenshots in them that the users use, and those are embedded in the PowerPoint slide. When I turned in the user guides to the top man who oversees our work, he asked me to make certain that it was 508 compliant. That's an assistive technology compliance.
Okay.
A fellow worker told me to run the guide through JAWS, which JAWS is actually a screen reader. It actually reads the screen. I did it, and JAWS ignored the screenshots. Exactly. JAWS does not read graphics. It does not read pictures. It just reads. text. So I had to go into the PowerPoint, and then I had to put essentially alternate text behind each graphic. You just right-click on that, and there's alternate text and so on, but you know, type a description. And then if you run JAWS, it will actually read this, the description for each graphic. But is there a way that I could, and now they want me to upload this PowerPoint as an e-learning application beyond what I've already done. How do I ensure that it's 508 compliant? Well, let me talk about 508 compliance. Section 508 is an amendment to the United States Workforce Rehabilitation Act of 1973. It's a federal law that mandates that all electronic and information technology developed, procured, maintained, or used by the federal government must be accessible to people with disabilities. Technology is deemed to be accessible if it can be used effectively by people with disabilities as those without. So it has to be able to handle blind people. That's why you need the reader. It has to be visually impaired. That's why you need to have larger fonts and higher contrast. And so there are various controls on it. If you have a full 508 compliant document, you have to actually complete a voluntary product accessibility template, a VPAT. And that VPAT needs to be posted on the creator's website so government officials can see what's compliant and what isn't. Now, that's kind of the background. That was an aside just for the audience. I know that LL didn't need that, but maybe the audience did this instead of this shorthand 508 stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know of any automated tools for PowerPoint presentation with embedded graphics because you've actually got to go in there and write the text for that alternate, write the alternate text behind each graphic. Now, the other thing that you've got to be careful of, if you embed tables, it's very hard for a reader to read the tables because they just read it line by line, and you might just get gibberish because they'll just go the first line of one cell, first line of the next cell, first line of the next cell, then do second lines. And so depending on how the reader reads the table, it may be totally not legible by somebody who's just listening to the words. So you may have to reformat the tables as, say, bulleted lists or something that's more easily read. Now, it does make sense to use something like JAWS to read, you know, some sort of screen reader to read it to see how the tables come through. And then you've got to just make certain that you conform to the font sizes and colors so that an individual can choose to adjust the font size. So you can't have the fonts as a fixed size. You have to make them so they can be adjusted. So you've got to use styles rather than fixed point sizes. If you want to take and convert your PowerPoint to HTML format, there are tools that will go PowerPoint to HTML, and then you can post the HTML to the web. Then the nice thing is, once it's on the web, there's a portal which will analyze the website for you. It's called Cynthia Says Portal, and it's a joint education and outreach project of High Software, ICDRI, and the Internet Society Disability and Special Needs Chapter. And you can actually get to that portal by going to www.contentquality.com. And that is it's a pretty good source, but it's very hard to pass that particular test. It's kind of interesting if you run, say, the White House website through mm-hmm. Cynthia, they don't pass.
Wow.
So it's a pretty stringent test. Great question.
Yes, very good question. Well, thanks for your emails. And, Doc, you know,
we're always
looking for emails, right?
We're always looking for emails, and we love those emails. Send the emails to techtalk@stratford.edu. We'll cover them on the air.
Right here on Tech Talk Radio on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2, Federal News Radio. Tech Talk continues right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Now it is time for... Yes, today we're going to feature Diane Greene. Diane Greene co-founded VMware with her husband, Mendel Rosenblum, where she served as president and CEO for nearly 10 years. Diane Greene was born in Rochester, New York around 1955. She received a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering in 1976 from the University of Vermont. She loves to sail.
Really?
Yes, she loves to sail. She loves the water. So then in 1978, Diane Greene went to MIT and received a Master of Science in Naval Architecture.
Huh.
So that was her passion, sailing. And so she thought she would work on designing ships or sailboats for the water. She went to San Francisco and worked for a consulting firm, and they designed large jacket structures, which are these massive four-legged devices that are better known as offshore drilling platforms. So she was very anxious. She did design work on it, and then she wanted to actually go to sea to examine her work. And then she discovered women are not allowed on oil rigs.
Really?
Did you know that?
No, I did not. Not till this very second.
No women are allowed on oil rigs.
I think I know why.
Yeah. I think
because there's no women on oil rigs.
Because there's no
for
women
reason.
On oil rigs. That's exactly right. So Greene quit. She said she was so fed up. There's no hairdresser on the oil rig, Jim. That's the reason why.
Okay. Send your cards and letters to Dr. Richard Schertz.
So Greene quit, and she moved in disgust to Hawaii to take up windsurfing.
I could move in disgust to Hawaii. I don't know about you.
So she took up windsurfing, you know, and I think she likes to
cleared her mind, I'm sure.
It did. I tried windsurfing off the, you know, off the coast of Spain. I'm a terrible windsurfer. You know, that sail, I got a cramp in my leg. It was blowing me out to the middle of the Mediterranean. Let me get back on track.
Diane Greene.
Oh, yeah, Diane Greene. No, thank you very much. Yeah, okay. Oh,
but
yeah.
But you digress.
After her windsurfing stint, she worked in the engineering department for Windsurfing International. And then she worked for Coleman. This is the Coleman camping gear company.
Yeah.
Because they were considering moving into the windsurfing business. Now, in 1988, she went to the University of California at Berkeley. UC Berkeley, they call it in short. She picked up a second master's degree in computer science. And there she met her future husband, who was an associate professor, Mendel Rosenblum. Now, she and Mendel were dating, and they got along quite well. He encouraged her. He was actually working on operating systems, on creating virtual operating systems. He had sort of, that was his kind of his passion, but he was like a, you know, typical college professor working on his research. And so he was just enjoying himself. But then after she got her master's degree, she wanted to have one last adventure before she would go back to work. So she served as a computer expert on a treasure hunt for a sunken Spanish galleon off of Saipan.
Are women allowed on pirate ships like that?
Apparently they are.
Okay, good.
Apparently they are. Well, computer experts are.
She was in drag.
So she came back after her treasure hunting expedition as the computer expert, and she worked for Tandem, which was a computer manufacturer, and then she worked for Silicon Graphics. During that time period after 1988, she got married, had two children, and was working at Tandem and Silicon Graphics. And then she was working on her second startup company in 1997. That was kind of a gap there and work on our second startup company. It was a software company which was later bought by CMGI. And then she was ready to move on to the next venture. And her husband was working on this virtual operating system. And Green said, look, why don't I help you take this researchy idea and package it, and let's try to turn it into a company. I mean, that was, you know, her husband was really not entrepreneurial per se, but that's like, okay, that's interesting. So in 1998, they formed VMware. So Green teamed with her husband, Mendel Rosenblum, who was professor of computer science. At that time, he then became a professor of computer science at Stanford. They teamed up with two of his graduate students that had been working on virtualization and an old graduate school friend from UC Berkeley. Now, they started out pretty small. Green quit her previous startup and signed up in 1998 as an unpaid employee. The following year, her husband, Rosenblum, took 2 years' leave from Stanford to work full-time at VMware. Now Diane Green agreed to help Rosenblum to basically productize the concept. And then she would move on. She wasn't planning to make this a whole career thing. And so she felt that he needed some help to actually, you know, commercialize the whole thing. Now, her plan was to set up the company, negotiate a few deals, and leave. But she stayed. Now, initially, they worked out of their home, and then they graduated to a small office, which they rented above the cheese house in a small shopping center across the street from Stanford.
I would spend a lot of time in the cheese house.
In the cheese house. And then they moved to another small house nearby when they needed a little bit more space, but everything was quite small. VMware was operated through 1998 in the stealth mode. Now, that means they didn't want anybody to know about it because they didn't want anybody to steal the ideas, so they weren't really trying to raise money. They had roughly 20 employees by the end of the year. Maybe they had just some VC funding. I don't know about the initial funding. The company was launched officially February 1999. The beta version of VMware was downloaded by more than 75,000 people the first day. Mm. Now let me have a sidebar. Okay, what is this VMware anyway? What's a virtual machine? Well, it turned out that in the beginning, like an Intel machine was designed to operate only one operating system. You'd install Windows and that'd be it. That would be it. Well, VMware provided a software layer that made every operating system think that it was the only operating system operating on that machine. And so you could have multiple operating systems running at once, and VMware would moderate their calls to the hardware, so the hardware also thought it was only dealing with one operating system. So it was like this playing this sleight of hand. You could have multiple virtual machines on the same system. Now, the reason this was so important was that, you see, data centers, every server had a different machine in the old days. And you had to design this for peak usage. So during most of the time, the servers might only be at 15% utilization. So you got all these machines using all this power, and the utilization is extremely low. If you can put multiple servers on the multiple operating systems on the same machine and multiple processes on the same machine, you can push up the utilization of the hardware up to 80%. And so you're able to make your data centers much more efficient and use much less power. So this was a huge breakthrough. It turned out that Intel had been working on virtual machines in the 60s. And then they gave up on it, and it wasn't until VMware that people actually commoditized it and made it practical. I mean, actually, we run VMware in our server room at Stratford. We're running about 60 or 70 virtual servers. I mean, it's just, you know, I don't have 60 or 70 machines. You can create a new virtual server in 10 minutes, and then you can load something on. You don't have to go out and buy more hardware. You just have to make certain you have the resources for it. Now, VMware delivered its – now I'm back off the sidebar.
You're off the sidebar.
VMware delivered its first product, VMware Workstation, May of 1999, entered the server market in 2001 with VMware GSX Server. Now, the company was acquired in 2004 by EMC Corporation. That was a computer storage corporation, for $625 million. That's not bad. They started in 1998, and they sold it in 2004 for $625 million. Not bad.
No.
Now, Green insisted when it was bought, Green stayed on, along with her husband, that when VMware was purchased by EMC, that they would have a distant relationship. Because, you see, EMC was competing with Microsoft. They were competing with a lot of VMware's clients. And if VMware became a competitive advantage for EMC, then they would lose their clients. So EMC treated VMware just as a standalone company. They had they weren't on the same database. They didn't share employees. They kept an arm's length distance, and that allowed VMware to continue to grow. Now, in August of 2007, this was 3 years after EMC bought VMware, they issued an IPO. And they basically released 10% of the stock in the IPO, and 10% of the stock for the IPO raised more than $1 billion. The IPO went from $29 on the initial price up to $51 the first day, producing a market capitalization of $20 billion. Mm. So this is what Green's thinking. 3 years ago, we sold the company for $625 million. EMC has been owning us for only 3 years, and I've built it, and they now have a valuation of $20 billion. Green said, you know, EMC got most of the upside, you see. So they weren't very happy.
No.
Now, you would think that Green would get, like, a big piece of this IPO. They only gave her 2.1% of it.
Huh.
So they were just a little pissed off. Well,
just,
that's a,
oh! Where's the dump button? You can say that,
I
think.
I can say that. Okay. That's a technical word. That's a technical word that you know, I don't know quite what it means.
No, we don't know what that means.
And
no.
So she did receive 2.1%, which is probably a few hundred million.
Mm-hmm. But still,
when there's $32 billion out there, you're saying, you know, hey, why don't I get more of it? Yeah, actually, it was her husband's idea.
Yeah.
But see, her husband, the reason this was the perfect combination, she was a very good manager. She would hire well. She would manage by objective. She had great management skills that allowed her to build the company up to a point of 5,000 employees and around $1.2 billion in revenue. And her husband's kind of a researchy guy.
Right. He was kind of the brains behind it.
Yeah, but see, if he would have been running the company, he'd have probably just given the technology to Microsoft,
sure,
and got nothing for it,
mm-hmm,
or published four or five papers. And he would have been noted as Mr. VMware, who got no money.
Right.
So she was able to commercialize this product. She was very effective at pulling the ideas out of the research lab and getting them into the marketplace. And she was quite proud of the fact that they assembled a team of very talented PhDs who would continue to innovate. Now, so she was a little upset in 2007.
Upset would be a better word.
That she only got 2.1%. And then she was really upset in July 8th of 2008, which was only the next year. She was unexpectedly fired.
Gee, who thought that?
She was replaced by Paul Meritz, who was running EMC's cloud computing division. So she was just crowded out. I guess she had a bad attitude after that IPO.
No kidding.
And then on September 10th, 2008, Rome Rosenblum, who was the company's chief scientist, resigned. So the founders, who actually started VMware, left, and EMC had it. But it's a great story of how a couple could take an idea that was in the university and build it up to a multi-billion dollar company. So now she's become an angel investor.
Mm-hmm.
She also likes to sail, so she has a trimaran. You know, instead of a catamaran has two holes,
a trimaran has
three holes. And she takes that out on San Francisco Bay. So I think she's living a good life, but she's still worried about missing the upside on VMware.
Now, it's still worried. I mean, several hundred million dollars is more than either of you or I.
I know. And so this is always the challenge when you have a startup. At what point do you sell?
Mm-hmm.
Do you hold out for the big bucks, or do you sell sooner?
Mm-hmm.
And I think since the big bucks came so quickly, she probably could have sold a little later and made quite a bit more.
Oh.
And there you know, all you want to know about Diane Green, who was co-founder with her husband, and served as president and CEO of VMware.
Hope you were paying attention, because the prize of free food awaits the person with the correct answer to the question we're about to ask on the pop quiz here on Federal News Radio, where Tech Talk is heard every Saturday morning over one of these fine radio stations in the Washington, D.C. area. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, and WTOP FM HD2 Washington. Tech Talk continues right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Church. It's this guy right here.
And I would be that guy right here. My name is Jim Russ, and this week for Dr. Richard Schertz, and for the second week in a row, the academic standards will be lowered here on the pop quiz so as to give everybody an equal, if not more than equal, chance. A few moments ago in Profiles in IT, we talked about Diane Greene, the co-founder of VMware, and she has been a lifelong what? Can you fill in the blank? What has Diane Greene been doing all of her life? If you can answer that question, you will win tickets for two for fine dining at the Escoffier at Stratford University, fine dining on the campus in Falls Church, or at the Cafe Karim at the campus in Woodbridge, Virginia. The number to call if you're calling from east of Rochester, New York, is 877-936-9333. From west of San Francisco, California, call us on 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line, as always, is 877-936-9333. The Pop Quiz on Tech Talk on Federal News Radio.
Did you hear about this guy, Larry Mente, who was a news anchor in Philadelphia, who was charged with hacking into the email account of Alicia Lane, his co-anchor?
Hey, there's a good idea.
Yeah, that's really a good way to make friends. He was a rival, and he would go in to log into her email account, both from at work and at home. He apparently logged in. They tracked it 537 times. It's what you don't realize. They can actually track the IP address when you go back. And so he logged in 537 times from his home and also from work, and over the course of 2 years, and then she would have, I guess, various social engagements or so whatever, and he would release this to the press. And ultimately, she was fired over some of her foibles. But at a hearing on August 27, Mente is expected to enter a plea of guilty. Oh, he's expected to enter a plea. We don't know if it's going to be guilty
right,
or innocent. He faces up to 6 months in prison if found guilty. It's interesting. Logging in and reading someone's email account, you'd be liable up to 6 months in prison.
Really?
That's interesting.
That is interesting.
Now, he either guessed her passwords or, he looked over her shoulder or he used a keystroke logger. And you could actually, just capture her keystrokes as she was typing them in.
Good grief.
Now,
that's scary.
I could, for instance, get a little USB keystroke logger for about $150. You just look them up on the internet. And then, where the... you know, the keyboard plugs into the computer. It's just a little unit here. The keyboard plugs into one side of it. The other end of it just plugs into the computer, and it's between the keyboard and the computer, and it just sits there, and it just remembers everything.
Mm-hmm.
So he could go in there before work, put in the little key, USB keystroke logger in her computer. It's not software. It's not detectable. It intercepts it completely. There's no way she could even detect that it was there. Then after she's finished using the computer, he just pulls it out, takes it home, plugs it into his computer, and he goes through and looks for the key sequences, and he could then easily get her password. Now, actually, you could have keystroke loggers on public computers, too, Internet cafes.
Sure.
You could put a keystroke logger on there, so you never really know for sure. But anyway, he did that. There's also software options for keystroke logging. You can download a lot of software. Some of it's free. It's not that expensive. But if you do keystroke logging with software, that is detectable because it could look like a virus or a Trojan. And so the software is detectable if you do the proper scan. Some software you get can actually send the keystrokes out over the Internet to another computer. So you actually install the software, and it just keeps reporting on the keystrokes to someplace else. But that's probably more difficult to do, and there's more of a trace there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, Google is aware of the fact that, you know, people may be getting into your website. So they added a new feature on Google Mail. They have a way to track account activity. So if you log onto your Gmail account and go to the bottom of the page, it says last account activity so many days ago, and it gives the IP address. If you click on the details, your Google account will give exactly how many times and when your account's been logged into and from what IP address.
Mm-hmm.
So you can tell whether somebody is accessing your account other than you simply by looking at the log. And it gives you the IP address, so you can do your own investigation in case somebody's going to be doing that. Now, if they're logging in from work, and your work is using something called network address translation, all the computers at work have the same Internet address, so you won't be able to tell anything there. You just have to tell by the time of the login whether it was there. Now, so the question is, how can you hide your passwords from keyloggers? If you were sitting there and you said, I don't know if I got a keylogger or not. One thing the keylogger can't do, it can't tell where the focus is on your computer. So if you click on the password block, you put the focus on the password. But you could click on another part of the block and put the focus somewhere. So you could type two letters on the password, change the focus to another part of the screen, type in some other letters, then go back to the password, put focus on it, type in the next part of the thing, and the keyboard logger is just going to see the whole stream, and it can't tell that you've changed focus from password to non-password to password.
That's a good idea.
And by changing the focus, you can keep people from using a keystroke logger on your password. I mean, it's a way to do it.
If you see somebody standing behind you, just smack them.
Yeah.
That would be my solution.
So there you go.
Maybe that's not a good one.
You know, so now we've got everybody paranoid about keystroke loggers.
Great.
But,
way to go, Doc.
That is my job.
Of making people paranoid.
That is my job.
It is our job to keep you on the cutting edge of technology, and we do that each and every Saturday here on Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, and 103.5 FM HD2. More Tech Talk Radio coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Budget analyst, the vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. This is Dr. Richard Schertz in the virtual faculty lounge with the technology crew. And now it's time for...
Profiles.
Yeah, there we go.
Profiles in IT.
And today we're going to be talking about Alan Matheson Turing.
Here are the three name people.
Yes, the three name people. Alan Turing was a British mathematician and logician who made major contributions to mathematics, cryptanalysis, logic, philosophy, and biology, into new areas that actually didn't have a name at the time and have since been called computer science, cognitive science, artificial intelligence, and artificial life. He was the son of a British member of the Indian Civil Service. Turing entered King's College, University of Cambridge, to study mathematics in 1931. After graduating in 1934, he was elected to a fellowship at King's College in recognition of his research in probability theory. In 1936, only 5 years after graduating from college, he published a seminal paper on computational numbers with an application to the Einstein-Dung problem, which is the decision problem, which sought a method for deciding which mathematical statements are provable within a formal mathematical system and which are not. This was a seminal work in the structure of computational algorithms and computers. As part of the proof, he showed that any effective calculatable function can be calculated by using a universal Turing machine, which is a type of abstract computer that Turing had introduced in the course of his proof. The universal Turing machine could actually be adapted to different problems using a behavior matrix, which we now call a computer program. So a universal machine could accept any computer program to do any kind of calculation. So the question is, what types of calculations can you solve with a computer program which you cannot solve? At the outbreak of hostilities in Germany in 1939, he joined Britain's wartime program at Bletchley Park to break the Enigma code. Remember, Enigma was the German machine which generated code. It was used by the military for all the radio communications. Turing and others designed a radically different code-breaking machine known as the Bombay. It kept the Allies supplied with intelligence for the remainder of the war. They were decoding over 39,000 messages each month, and at the peak of the war, it went up to 84,000 messages a month. Turing was made an officer in the Order of the British Empire for his work. In 1945, Turing was recruited by the National Physics Lab to start and develop an electronic computer based on his concept of the universal Turing machine. But His work at that particular National Physics Laboratory did not produce the first machine. The first machine was actually built at the University of Manchester in 1948, where they built the first electronic stored program digital computer based on his concept of the universal Turing machine. And after they successfully made that machine, he actually decided to go to the University of Manchester and take over as the directorship of that particular organization. He started writing programs for that machine, and he produced programs for the first commercial electronic digital computer in 1948. In 1950, he asked a very simple philosophical question: can machines think? So the question was, could you make a computer so smart that it would be as smart as the people who created it? He created something called the Turing test, where you would have two people, you'd have a computer and a person communicating with a third person who was the judge through texting, so they couldn't see who they were talking to. And the third person would talk to the computer and the person, and if the computer could convince the judge that in fact they were a person and not a computer, then they passed the Turing test. And this Turing test has been used as a criterion to determine whether machines think, because you really have trouble defining it. In 52, his life came to a sad end. He was prosecuted for homosexuality.
Prosecuted?
Which in 1952 was illegal.
This is in Great Britain?
In Britain. It was illegal. He lost his security clearance. He was sentenced to 1 year of hormone treatment. And because he was because he lost his security clearance, he lost all access to his work. He couldn't talk about it because it was classified, and he was really quite depressed. He'd started working on another project dealing with artificial life, and he wrote a program dealing with the chemical basis of genetic manipulation, and he was trying to apply the computer to that particular problem. He was discovered dead in his bed, poisoned by cyanide at age 42, committing suicide after that. So it was a sad ending to really quite an illustrious career. Some have postulated.
Why did they think? Did they think it was suicide?
It was pretty clear because he had been talking about it up to that point after he lost his clearance. Many have postulated that Apple's logo, when he died, he had an apple with one bite taken. He had put the cyanide in the apple, and he took a bite out of the apple, and it was laying beside him, kind of a symbolic thing.
That would be a clue, yes.
It was kind of a symbolic thing. He was sort of, the way, Socrates died of poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
And so some have postulated that Apple's logo with one bite taken out is a tribute to Turing. But
that
could just be
a coincidence
or an urban legend.
Mm-hmm.
And so he actually then did two things. He addressed the issue of the fundamental computer architecture, and his concept of the universal Turing machine was the basis of all of our modern-day computer science.
So,
and the question of can computers think was really philosophical. And he really started addressing this at the philosophical level.
So you could say even during his early time, there were some forms of computers. The machine the Germans had was essentially a computer that created code, right? But he was trying to take it to the next level to see if the computer could be more versatile and really
become an artificial brain. There were mechanical computers. Because, we talked about Charles Babbage's machine that was programmed by Ada Lovelace.
And that was in the
1840s.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think you know what's coming, don't you?
I know what's coming.
Yeah, so,
Dancing Queen. Yeah.
And no, not Dancing Queen.
This is Ada Love. This not. It's mm-hmm. not that Ada Love.
Oh, not that. Oh.
And so the
oh yeah.
Down boy.
And so the Enigma was another mechanical computer. What he did, people were having instances of mechanical computers who would compute one thing. He was trying to provide a theoretical framework saying what is computable and what is not computable. He was laying the underlying theoretical framework for all computers, for any computer architecture, and this became the foundational theory of all computer science. So this was more general in nature than just making one instance of a mechanical computer.
Now we're going to take it one step further. As we mentioned earlier, we all have dates for today's Tech Talk, and we're going to talk to our dates. And we're going to relate this to Turing coming up on Tech Talk in just a moment.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. an executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford Culinary Arts and Hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Dr. Richard Schertz in the virtual faculty lounge of Stratford University. And we, the last segment, we're talking about Alan Turing and the Turing test. The Turing test, of course, is a way that he proposed for deciding whether computers can think. And you basically have a computer who converses to a judge by texting, and the judge has to decide, is this a person or is this a computer? There are a number of Turing tests which have come out over the years, and they're available on the web. The first test that came out produced the Loebner Prize for Artificial Intelligence. It was the first formal Turing test, and it began in 1991. And each year they have a winner, and the winner wins anywhere from about $2,200 to $2,500. If there is a winner who can actually fool all of the judges all the time, the prize will escalate to a full $100,000. In 2006, the winner was Joan by Rollo Carpenter. And you can reach Joan by going to www.jabberwacky.com, and you can select George, Joan from the menu at the top. The 2005 winner was George, also by Rollo Carpenter, and also is at the Jabberwacky site. And you just go to the top menu and select George. The 2004 winner of the Loebner Prize was Alice by Richard Wallace. And you can reach Alice by going to alicebot.org. Now, there's a second formal Turing test, which is on the web, and that is called the Chatterbox Challenge, because some of these people call these bots that actually trying to act like they're human chatterboxes. And it began in 2001, has been running continuously. The 2007 winner of the Chatterbox Challenge was Bilge Smith, S-M-Y-T-H-E, by Patty Robertson. And you can go to Patty Roberts. You can reach that by going to personalityforge.com. The 2006 winner was TalkBot by Wendell Cowart. And the 2004 winner was Alice by Richard Wallace. And that's the same winner that they also won the Loebner Prize. Now, what we decided to do... Oh, there's one other thing I'd wanted to say. Probably the most famous chatterbox was the first one that came out around 20 years ago, Eliza. Eliza, E-L-I-Z-A. You can just search this on the web and come up with Eliza. Now, what we're going to do, we are now, each of us are going to be talking to a different chatterbox.
We all have dates.
Jim is going to be talking to...
So we have dates. A little romantic music, please.
That's right. Jim is going to be talking to his date, his Eliza. That was the first one that came along. I'm going to be talking to my date, Alice. Alice is the... Is sort of the one that came around 2004. Naveed wanted the hip date, the most recent winner, Joan.
Joan.
So we're all going to be talking to our dates, and we're going to be asking them a series of questions. We're going to see, you know, we're going to judge whether we think these really are, whether these computers have gotten smarter or dumber over the years.
Mm-hmm. So I just logged on to Eliza, and I asked her if she likes Tech Talk. Uh-huh. Oh, I like Tech Talk. So I asked her next, do you like Naveed? And the answer is, oh, I like Naveed. Let's see, do you like Dr. Schertz? Mm-hmm. Oh, I like Dr. Schertz. So I think I know where we're going here. So I was talking to her earlier, so I'd like to recreate some of what I did.
Oh, yeah.
What? Wait a minute. What is life? And let's see what she says. Does this question interest you? Well, of course it does.
Yes.
So I've been asking her questions, and everything gets answered with a question. Yes, are you sure? So I asked her eventually, why can't you ask me something other than a question? You know, answer without, yeah. So, and the answer there was, am I upsetting you? And so we kind of went downhill here with Eliza.
Because, Eliza was one of the first generation of the bots, and she basically just turns around, takes the syntax from your sentence and turns it around in some fashion.
Right.
And doesn't really remember previous things that were talked about. Now, Alice was a little bit more advanced. So we'll see what Alice, I say, do you ever listen to Tech Talk Radio on WTWP? Alice, I listen to it from time to time, so it's not
so
bad.
That's good.
Yeah. Do you ever listen to the podcast? I listen to it from time to time, too. Do you like the hosts? I'm not sure I like it. I like my creator. Do you like Naveed? No, I don't care for it at all.
You're batting 500. Eliza likes you, but Alice, she's not so
high. 500 is pretty good. 500's not bad.
I think the crucial thing for you is, does Joan like you? Because she's your date
Joan
for today.
Joan is the modern woman who won the most recent Loebner Award.
I think most modern women like Naveed, so let's find
Naveed.
Out.
How's your date going over there?
Well, she was asking me about the meaning of life, and I told her that I obviously have no idea. If I did, I'd be doing something else with my life. She insisted that she's not artificial intelligence, and I didn't set her that I didn't say you were, so relax. And then I asked her if she listens to Tech Talk Radio, and she said, not really, do you? And
no, we don't.
These bots are getting dumber, I think, because, you know, don't you notice this is kind of a trend?
Well, Eliza really didn't give me any help.
But she said she always listens.
She listens, yes, but she was lying to me, quite obviously, because all she does is answer with questions.
Yeah.
These are pretty interesting machines.
So these are kind of fun. Now, there's another. These are all people that are competing for the Turing Prize. And if you go to after the show, I post all these links on the Tech Talk homepage. You just go to the Tech Talk homepage, drop down the show date for today, and I'll have that posted in a couple of hours. All these links will be there if you want to look them up. There's another interesting website dealing with the Turing test. It's called the Turing Hub. That's TuringHub.com. Now, what you do there, you log into the Turing Hub, and it hooks you up with a robot as well, but you might also be talking to another person who's logged into the Turing Hub. So the question is, as you're chatting with somebody, you might actually be chatting with a real person or chatting with a bot, you don't know. After 5 minutes of chatting, you're supposed to judge, was it a computer or was it a person?
Have you tried this?
And somebody also judges you, whether you're a computer or you're a person.
How good are you at figuring out whether it's a computer or a person?
I think I did okay.
You know what? I tried it out a little while ago. It didn't tell me whether or not I was talking to a person or a computer, but it just said what percentage of people who tried the test voted that they were talking to a computer versus talking to a person. That's all. It didn't give
me
an answer.
And so it was really hard to figure out what that meant.
Now, really. how about the other way around? Have you tried it to see if anybody thinks you're a computer?
There was a guy I was reading about a guy who somebody got his IM account, and they said that he was a celebrity. This is kind of a story. So he started, people were barging and saying, hi, are you a celebrity? And he'd say no. Finally, he started playing along with it. And people, he said, oh, yeah, you know, Cher's going to come over and we're going to go out party and, you know, Hilton's going to be over here soon. And then pretty soon he got on a list of being a sex bot and people were calling him. And after a while, people said, we think you're just a computer, that you're a computerized sex bot. And he could not convince people that he was a real person. People would IM him. He would talk to them and say, no, you're a computer. And the more he tried to prove that he was a person, the more they thought that he was a computer.
That's pretty funny. So, this celebrity wasn't David Byrd, was it?
No.
Over here, love me.
I don't think it was David Byrd at all. So you can play around with this Turing test. I think it's pretty clear when you start looking at these computers that we're a long way from having a computer as smart as HAL in 2001.
Yeah.
It's going to be a while before we do that.
That's it for this week. Join us next Saturday at 9 for more Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio. 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. 103.5 FM HD2. Learn all about the show by going to techtalkonline.com and learn about our fine sponsors at Stratford University by going to stratford.edu. See you next week.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.